bullets to kill them.
I don't think so, Steve said.
I think normal bullets can do the job. You might have to use lots of them, but they should work.
Steve knows everything there is to know about horror facts. He's read every sort of horror book there is. He says every story has at least some bit of truth in it, even if most are made up.
Do you think the wolf man at the Sickly Freak is a werewolf?
I asked. Steve shook his head.
From what I've read, he said, the wolf men in freak shows are normally just very hairy guys. Some of them are more like animals than people and eat live chickens and stuff, but they're not werewolves. A werewolf will be no good in a show because it can only turn into a wolf when there's a full moon. Every other night it would be a normal guy.
Oh,
I said.
What about the snake boy? Do you...
Hey, he laughed. Save the questions for later.
The shows long ago were terrible. The owners used to starve the freaks and keep them locked up in cages and treat them like dirt. But I don't know what it's going to be like. They might not even be real freaks. They might only be people in costumes.
The freak show was being held at a place near the other side of town. We had to leave not long after 9 o'clock to make sure we got there in time. We could have got a cab, except we'd use most of our pocket money to replace the cash Steve took from his mum. Besides, it was more fun walking. It was spookier. We told ghost stories as we walked. Steve did most of the talking because he knows way more than me. He was on top form. Sometimes he forgets the ends of stories or gets names mixed up, but not tonight. It was better than being with Stephen King. It was a long walk, longer than we thought, and we almost didn't make it on time. We had to run the last half kilometre. We were panting like dogs when we got there. The venue was an old theatre which used to show movies. I'd passed it once or twice in the past. Steve told me once that it was shut down because a boy fell off the balcony and got killed. He said it was haunted. I asked my dad about it, and he said it was a load of lies. It's hard sometimes to know whether you should believe the stories your dad tells you or the ones your best friend tells you. There was no name outside the door, and no cars parked nearby, and no queue. We stopped out front and bent over until we got our breath back. Then we stood and looked at the building. It was tall and dark and covered in jagged grey stones. Lots of the windows were broken, and the door looked like a giant's open mouth.
"Are you sure this is the place?"
I asked, trying not to sound scared.
"This is what it says on the tickets,"
Steve said, and checked again just to be sure.
"Yep, this is it.
Maybe the police found out and the freaks had to move on,"
I said.
"Maybe there isn't any show tonight."
"Maybe,"
Steve said. I looked at him and licked my lips nervously.
"What do you think we should do?"
I asked. He stared back at me and hesitated before replying.
"I think we should go in," he finally said.
"We've come this far. It'd be silly to turn back now without knowing for sure."
"I agree,"
I said, nodding. Then I gazed up at the scary building and gulped. It looked like the sort of place you saw in a horror movie, where lots of people go in but don't come out.
"Are you scared?"
I asked Steve.
"No,"
he said, but I could hear his teeth chattering and knew he was lying.
"Are you?"
he asked.
"Course not,"
I said. We looked at each other and grinned. We knew we were both terrified, but at least we were together. It's not so bad being scared if you're not alone.
"Shall we enter?"
Steve asked, trying to sound cheerful.
"Might as well,"
I said. We took a deep breath, crossed our fingers, then started up the steps. There were 9 stone steps leading up to the door, each one cracked and covered with moss, and went in. Chapter 8. We found ourselves standing in a long, dark, cold corridor. I had my jacket on, but shivered all the same. It was freezing.
"Why is it so cold?"
I asked Steve.
"It was warm outside."
"Old houses are like that," he told me.
We started to walk. There was a light down by the other end, so the further in we got, the brighter it became. I was glad of that. I don't think I could have made it otherwise. It would have been too scary. The walls were scratched and scribbled on, and bits of the ceiling were flaky. It was a creepy place. It would have been bad enough in the middle of the day, but this was 10 o'clock, only 2 hours away from midnight.
"There's a door here,"
Steve said and stopped. He pushed it ajar, and it creaked loudly. I almost turned and ran. It sounded like the lid of a coffin being tugged open. Steve showed no fear and stuck his head in. He said nothing for a few seconds while his eyes got used to the dark, then pulled back.
"It's the stairs up to the balcony," he said.
"Where the kid fell from?"
I asked.
"Yes."
"Do you think we should go up?"
I asked. He shook his head.
"I don't think so. It's dark up there. No sign of any sort of light. We'll try it if we can't find another way in, but I think..."
"Can I help you boys?"
somebody said behind us, and we nearly jumped out of our skins. We turned around quickly, and the tallest man in the world was standing there, glaring down on us as if we were a couple of rats. He was so tall, his head almost touched the ceiling. He had huge bony hands and eyes that were so dark they looked like two black coals stuck in the middle of his face.
"Isn't it rather late for two little boys like yourselves to be out and about?"
he asked. His voice was as deep and croaky as a frog's, but his lips hardly seemed to move. He would have made a great ventriloquist.
"We..."
Steve began, but had to stop and lick his lips before he could continue.
"We're here to see the sick, the freak," he said.
"Are you?"
The man nodded slowly.
"Do you have tickets?"
"Yes,"
Steve said, and showed his.
"Very good,"
the man muttered. Then he turned to me and said,
"How about you, Darren? Do you have a ticket?"
"Yes,"
I said, reaching into my pocket. Then I stopped dead in my tracks.
He knew my name. I glanced at Steve, and he was shaking in his boots.
The tall man smiled. He had black teeth, and some were missing, and his tongue was a dirty shade of yellow.
"My name is Mr. Toll," he said. "I own the Cirque du Freak."
"How did you know my friend's name?"
Steve asked bravely. Mr. Toll laughed and bent down so he was eyeball to eyeball with Steve.
"I know lots of things," he said softly. "I know your names. I know where you live. I know you don't like your mummy or your daddy."
He turned to face me, and I took a step back. His breath stank to the high heavens.
"I know you didn't tell your parents you were coming here. And I know how you won your ticket."
"How?"
I asked. My teeth were shaking so much I wasn't sure if he heard me or not. If he did, he decided not to answer, because next he stood up and turned away from us.
"We must hurry,"
he said, beginning to walk. I thought he would take giant steps, but he didn't. He took short ones.
"The show is about to begin. Everyone else is present and seated. You are late, boys. You're lucky we didn't start without you."
He turned a corner at the end of the corridor. He was only 2 or 3 steps in front of us, but when we turned the corner, he was sitting behind a long table covered with a black cloth which reached down to the floor. He was wearing a tall red hat now and a pair of gloves.
"Tickets, please,"
he said, reached out, took them, opened his mouth, and put the tickets in, then chewed them to pieces and swallowed.
"Very well,"
he said.
"You may go in now. We normally don't welcome children, but I can see you are two fine, courageous young men. We will make an exception.
There were two blue curtains in front of us drawn across the end of the hall. Steve and me looked at each other and gulped.
Do we walk straight on?
Steve asked.
Of course, Mr. Tall said.
Isn't there a lady with a torch?
I asked. He laughed.
If you want someone to hold your hand, he said, you should have brought a babysitter.
That made me mad, and I forgot for a moment how afraid I was.
All right,
I snapped, stepping forward, surprising Steve. If that's the way it is. I walked forward quickly and pushed past the curtains. I don't know what those curtains were made of, but they felt like spider webs. I stopped once past. I was in a short corridor, and another pair of curtains were draped across the walls a few meters in front. There was a sound behind, and then Steve was by my side. We could hear noises on the other side of the curtains.
Do you think it's safe? I asked.
I think it's safer to go forward than backwards, he answered. I don't think Mr. Tall would like it if we turned back.
How do you think he knew all that stuff about us?
I asked. He must be able to read minds, Steve replied.
Oh,
I said, and thought about that for a few seconds.
He nearly scared the life out of me, I admitted. Me too,
Steve said. Then we stepped forward. It was a huge room. The chairs had been ripped out of the theatre long ago, but deck chairs had been set up in their place. We looked for spare seats. The entire theatre was packed, but we were the only children there. I could feel people watching us and whispering. The only spaces were in the fourth row from the front. We had to step over lots of legs to get there, and people were grumbling. When we sat down, we realized they were good seats, because we were right in the middle and nobody tall was in front of us. We had a perfect view of the stage and could see everything.
Do you think they sell popcorn?
I asked.
At a freak show?
Steve snorted.
Get real. They might sell snake eggs and lizard eyes, but I'll bet anything you like they don't sell popcorn.
The people in the theatre were a mixed bunch. Some were dressed stylishly, others in tracksuits. Some were as old as the hills, others just a few years older than Steve and me. Some chatted confidently to their companions and behaved as though at a football match. Others sat quietly in their chairs and gazed around nervously. What everyone shared was a look of excitement. I could see it in their eyes, the same light that was shining in Steve's and mine. We all somehow knew that we were in for something special, the like of which we'd never seen before. Then a load of trumpets blew and the whole place went quiet. The trumpets blew for ages and ages, getting louder and louder, and every light went out until the theatre was pitch black. I began to get scared again, but it was too late to leave. All of a sudden, the trumpets stopped, and there was silence. My ears were ringing, and for a few seconds I felt dizzy. Then I recovered and sat up straight in my seat. Somewhere, high up in the theatre, someone switched on a green light, and the stage lit up.
It looked eerie. For about a minute, nothing else happened.
Then two men came on, pulling a cage. It was on wheels and covered with what looked like a huge bearskin rug. When they got to the middle of the stage, they stopped, dropped the ropes, and ran back into the wings. For a few seconds more, silence. Then the trumpets blew again, three short blasts. The rug came flying off the cage, and the first freak was revealed. That was when the screaming began.
End of disc one.
Disc 2.
Chapter 9. There was no need for the screaming. The freak was quite shocking, but he was chained up inside the cage. I think the people who screamed did it for fun, the way people scream on a roller coaster, not because they were actually afraid. It was the wolf man. He was very ugly, hair all over his body. He only wore a piece of cloth around his middle, like Tarzan, so we could see his hairy legs and belly and back and arms. He had a long, bushy beard, which covered most of his face. His eyes were yellow, and his teeth were red. He shook the bars of the cage and roared. It was pretty frightening. Lots more people screamed when he roared. I nearly screamed myself, except I didn't want to look like a baby. The wolf man went on shaking the bars and jumping about before calming down. When he was sitting on his backside, the way dogs do, Mr. Tall walked on and spoke.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said. And even though his voice was low and croaky, everybody could hear what he was saying. "Welcome to the Cirque du Freak, home of the world's most remarkable human beings. We are an ancient circus," he went on. "We have toured for 500 years. Bringing the grotesque to generation after generation. Our lineup has changed many times, but never our aim, which is to astound and terrify you. We present acts both threatening and bizarre. You can find nowhere else in the world. Those who are easily scared should leave now," he warned. "I am sure there are people who came tonight thinking this was a joke. Maybe they thought our freaks would be people in masks or armless misfits. This is not so. Every act you see tonight is real. Each performer is unique. And none are armless."
That was the end of his speech, and he walked off stage. Two pretty women in shiny suits came on next and unlocked the door of the wolfman's cage. A few people looked scared, but nobody left. The wolfman was yapping and howling when he first came out of the cage until one of the ladies hypnotized him with her fingers. The other lady spoke to the crowd.
"You must be very quiet,"
she said in a foreign accent.
"The wolfman will not be able to hurt you as long as we control him, but a loud sound could wake him up, and then he would be deadly."
When they were ready, they stepped down from the stage and walked the hypnotized wolfman through the theater. His hair was a dirty gray color, and he walked with a stoop, fingers hanging down around his knees. The lady stayed by his side and warned people to be quiet. They let you stroke him if you wanted, but you had to do it gently. Steve rubbed him when he went by, but I was afraid he might wake up and bite me, so I didn't.
"What did it feel like?"
I asked as quietly as I could.
"It was spiky," Steve replied, "like a hedgehog."
He lifted his fingers to his nose and sniffed.
"Oh, it smells strange too, like burning rubber."
The wolfman and ladies were about halfway down the rows of seats when there was a big bang. I don't know what made the noise, but suddenly the wolfman began roaring, and he shoved the ladies away from him. People screamed, and those nearest him leapt from their seats and ran. One woman wasn't quick enough, and the wolfman leapt on her and dragged her to the ground. She was screaming, fit to burst, but nobody tried to help her. He rolled her over onto her back and bared his teeth. She stuck her hand up to push him away, but he got his teeth on it and bit it off. A couple of people fainted when they saw that, and loads more began yelling and running. Then, out of nowhere, Mr. Tall appeared behind the wolfman and wrapped his arms around him. The wolfman struggled for a few seconds, but Mr. Tall whispered something in his ear, and he relaxed. While Mr. Tall led him back to the stage, the women in the suits calmed down the crowd and told them to return to their seats. While the crowd hesitated, the woman with the bitten-off hand went on screaming. Blood was pumping out of the end of her wrist, covering the ground and other people. Steve and me were staring at her, our mouths wide open, wondering if she was going to die. Mr. Tall returned from the stage, picked up the severed hand, and gave a loud whistle. Two people in blue robes with hoods over their heads ran forward. They were short, not much bigger than me or Steve, but with thick arms and legs and lots of muscles. Mr. Tall sat the woman up and whispered something in her ear. She stopped screaming and sat still. Mr. Tall took hold of the wrist, then reached into his pocket and took out a small brown leather pouch. He opened it with his free hand and sprinkled a sparkly pink powder onto the bleeding wrist. Then he stuck the hand against it and nodded to the two people in the blue suits. They produced a pair of needles and loads of orange string. And then, to the amazement of everybody in the theatre, they started to stitch the hand back onto the wrist. The people in blue robes stitched for 5 or 6 minutes. The woman didn't feel any pain, even though their needles were going in and out of her flesh all the way around the wrist. When finished, they put their needles and unused thread away and returned to wherever they'd come from. Their hoods never slipped from their faces, so I couldn't tell if they were men or women. When they'd gone, Mr. Tall let go of the woman's hand and stepped back.
"Move your fingers,"
he said. The woman stared at him blankly.
"Move your fingers,"
he said again. And this time she gave them a wiggle.
They moved. Everybody gasped. The woman stared at the fingers as though she didn't believe they were real. She gave them another wiggle. Then she stood and lifted the hand above her head. She shook it as hard as she could, and it was good as new. You could see the stitches, but there was no more blood and the fingers seemed to be working fine.
"You will be okay,"
Mr. Tall told her.
"The stitches will fall out after a couple of days. It will be fine after that."
"Maybe that's not good enough,"
someone shouted, and a big red-faced man stepped forward.
"I'm her husband,"
he said.
"And I say we should go to a doctor and then the police. You can't let a wild animal like that out into a crowd. What if he'd bitten her head off?"
"Then she would be dead,"
Mr. Tall said calmly.
"Listen, Buster,"
the husband began, but Mr. Tall interrupted.
"Tell me, sir,"
Mr. Tall said.
"Where were you when the wolfman was attacking?"
"Me?"
the man asked.
"Yes,"
Mr. Tall said.
"You are her husband. You were sitting beside her when the beast escaped. Why did you not leap to her rescue?"
"Well, there was no time. I couldn't. I wasn't..."
No matter what he said, the husband couldn't win, because there was only one true answer. He'd been running away, looking after himself.
"Listen to me,"
Mr. Tall said.
"I gave fair warning. I said this show could be dangerous. This is not a nice, safe circus where nothing goes wrong. Mistakes can and do happen. And sometimes people end up a lot worse off than your wife. That's why this show is banned. That's why we must play in all theaters in the middle of the night. Most of the time, things go smoothly and nobody gets hurt. But we cannot guarantee your safety.
Mr. Tool turned around in a circle and seemed to look everybody in the eye while turning.
We cannot guarantee anybody's safety,
he roared.
Another accident like this is unlikely, but it could happen. Once again I say, if you are afraid, leave. Leave now, before it is too late.
A few people did leave, but most stayed to see the rest of the show, even the woman who nearly lost her hand.
Do you want to go?
I asked Steve, half hoping he'd say yes. I was excited, but scared as well.
Are you crazy? He said. This is great! You don't want to go, do you?
No way,
I lied, and slapped on a shaky little smile. If only I hadn't been so scared of looking like a coward. I could have left and everything would have been fine, but no, I had to act like a big man and sit it out to the end. If you only knew how many times I've wished since then that I'd fled with all the speed in my body and never looked back. Chapter 10. As soon as Mr. Tall had left the stage and we'd settled back into our seats, the second freak, Alexander Ribbs, came on. He was more of a comedy act than a scary one, which was just what we needed to calm us down after the terrifying start. I happened to look over my shoulder while he was on, and noticed two of the blue-hooded people down on their knees, cleaning blood from the floor. Alexander Ribbs was the skinniest man I'd ever seen. He looked like a skeleton. There seemed to be no flesh on him. He would have been frightening, except he had a wide, friendly smile. Funny music played and he danced around the stage. He was dressed in ballet clothes and looked so ridiculous that soon everyone was laughing. After a while, he stopped dancing and began stretching. He said he was a contortionist, somebody with bones like rubber who can bend every which way. First, he tilted his head back so far it looked like it had been cut off. He turned round so we could see his upside-down face, then went on leaning backwards until his head was touching the floor. Then he put his hands round the backs of his legs and pulled his head through until it was sticking up in front of him. It looked like it was growing out of his stomach. He got a huge round of clapping for that, after which he straightened up and began twisting his body around like a curly-whirly straw. He kept twisting and twisting 5 times around until his bones began to creak from the strain. He stood like that for a minute, then began to unwind really, really fast. Next, he got 2 drumsticks with furry ends. He took the first drumstick and hit one of his bony ribs with it. He opened his mouth, and a musical note sprang out. It sounded like the noise pianos make. Then he closed his mouth and struck a rib on the other side of his body. This time, it was a louder, higher note. After a few more practice goes, he kept his mouth open and began playing songs. He played London Bridge is Falling Down, some songs by the Beatles, and the theme tunes from a few well-known TV shows. The skinny man left the stage to shouts for more, but none of the freaks ever came back to do an encore. After Alexander Ribbs came Rama's 2 bellies, and he was as fat as Alexander was thin. He was enormous. The floorboards creaked as he walked out onto the stage. He walked close to the edge and kept pretending he was about to topple forward, I could see people in the front rows getting worried, and some jumped back out of the way when he got close. I don't blame them. He would have squashed them flat as a pancake if he fell. He stopped in the middle of the stage.
"Hello,"
he said. He had a nice voice, low and squeaky.
"My name is Ramus Tubelis, and I really have two bellies. I was born with them, the same way certain animals are. The doctors were stunned and said I was a freak. That's why I joined this show and I'm here tonight."
The ladies who had hypnotized the Wolfman came out with two trolleys full of food. Cakes, chips, hamburgers, packets of sweets, and heads of cabbage. There was stuff there that I hadn't even seen before, never mind tasted.
"Yum, yum,"
Rama said. He pointed to a huge clock being lowered by ropes from above. It stopped about 3 meters above his head.
"How long do you think it will take me to eat all of this?"
he asked, pointing to the food.
"There will be a prize for the person who guesses closest."
"An hour!"
somebody yelled.
45 minutes!"
somebody else roared.
2 hours, 10 minutes and 33 seconds!"
another person shouted. Soon everybody was calling out. I said 1 hour and 3 minutes. Steve said 29 minutes. The lowest guess was 17 minutes. When we were finished guessing, the clock started to tick, and Rama started to eat. He ate like the wind. His arms moved so fast you could hardly see them. His mouth didn't seem to close at all. He shoveled food in, swallowed, and moved on. Everybody was amazed. I felt sick as I watched. Some people actually were sick. Finally, Rama scoffed the last bun and the clock above his head stopped ticking. 4 minutes and 56 seconds! He'd eaten all that food in less than 5 minutes. I could hardly believe it. It didn't seem possible, even for a man with two bellies.
"That was nice,"
Rama said.
"But I could have done with more dessert."
While we clapped and laughed, the ladies in shiny suits rolled the trolleys away and brought on a new one, packed with glass statues and forks and spoons and bits of metal junk.
"Before I begin," Rama said, "I must warn you not to try this at home. I can eat things which would choke and kill normal people. Do not try to copy me. If you do, you may die."
He began eating. He started with a couple of nuts and bolts which he sucked down without blinking. After a few handfuls, he gave his big round belly a shake, and we could hear the noise of the metal inside. His belly heaved, and he spat the nuts and bolts back out. If there had only been one or two, I might have thought he was keeping them under his tongue or at the sides of his cheeks, but not even Rama's two-belly's mouth was big enough to hold that load. Next, he ate the glass statues. He crunched the glass up into small pieces before swallowing it with a drink of water. Then he ate the spoons and forks. He twisted them up into circles with his hands, popped them into his mouth, and let them slide down. He said his teeth weren't strong enough to tear through metal. After that, he swallowed a long metal chain, then paused to catch his breath. His belly began rumbling and shaking. I didn't know what was going on until he gave a heave and I saw the top of the chain come out of his mouth. As the chain came out, I saw that the spoons and forks were wrapped around it. He'd managed to poke the chain through the hoops inside his belly. It was unbelievable. When Ramos left the stage, I thought nobody could top such an act. I was wrong. Chapter 11. A couple of people in the blue hooded robes came around after Rama's two bellies selling gifts. There was some really cool stuff, like chocolate models of the nuts and bolts that Ramus ate, and rubber dolls of Alexander ribs, which you could bend and stretch. And there were clippings of the Wolfman's hair. I bought a bit of that. It was tough and wiry, sharp as a knife.
"There will be more novelties later,"
Mr. Tall announced from the stage.
So don't spend all your money right away.
How much is the glass statue? Steve asked.
It was the same sort that Rama's two bellies had eaten. The person in the blue hood didn't say anything, but stuck out a sign with the price on.
I can't read, Steve said. Will you tell me how much it costs?
I stared at Steve and wondered why he was lying. The person in the hood still didn't speak. This time he or she shook his head quickly and moved on before Steve could ask anything else.
What was that about?
I asked. Steve shrugged.
I wanted to hear it speak, he said, to see if it was human or not.
Of course it's human, I said. What else could it be?
I don't know, he said.
That's why I was asking. Don't you think it's strange that they keep their faces covered all the time?
Maybe they're shy, I said.
Maybe,
he said. But I could tell he didn't believe that. When the people selling the gifts were finished, the next freak came on. It was the bearded lady. And at first, I thought it was meant to be a joke, because she didn't have a beard. Mr. Tall stood behind her and said,
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special act. Truska here is new to our family. She is one of the most incredible performers I have ever seen, with a truly unique talent.
Mr. Tall walked off. Truska was very beautiful, dressed in flowing red robes which had many shades. Lots of the men in the theatre began to cough and shift around in their seats. Truska stepped closer to the edge of the stage so we could see her better, then said something that sounded like a seal barking. She put her hands on her face, one at either side, and stroked the skin gently. Then she held her nose shut with two fingers and tickled her chin with her other hand. An extraordinary thing happened. She began to grow a beard. Hairs crept out, first on her chin, then her upper lip, then the sides of her face, finally all over. It was long and blonde and straight. It grew about 10 or 11 centimeters, then stopped. She took her fingers away from her nose and stepped down into the crowd, where she walked around and let people pull on the beard and stroke it. The beard continued growing as she walked, until finally it reached down to her feet. When she arrived at the rear of the theatre, she turned and walked back to the stage. Even though there was no breeze in here, her hair blew about wildly, tickling people's faces as she passed. When she was back on the stage, Mr. Tall asked if anybody had a pair of scissors. Lots of women did. Mr. Tall invited a few up.
The Cirque du Freak will give one solid bar of gold to anyone who can slice off Truska's beard,
he said, and held up a small yellow ingot to show he wasn't joking. That got a lot of people excited, and for 10 minutes, nearly everybody in the theatre tried cutting off her beard. But they couldn't. Nothing could cut through the bearded lady's hair, not even a pair of garden shears which Mr. Tall handed out. The funny thing was, it still felt soft, just like ordinary hair. When everyone had admitted defeat, Mr. Tall emptied the stage, and Truska stood in the middle again. She stroked her cheeks as before and held her nose, but this time, the beard grew back in. It took about 2 minutes for the hairs to disappear back inside, and then she looked exactly as she had when she first came out. She left to huge applause, and the next act came on almost directly after. His name was Hans Hans. He began by telling us about his father, who'd been born without legs. Hans's father learned to get around on his hands just as well as other people could on their feet, and had taught his children his secrets. Hans then sat down, pulled up his legs, and wrapped his feet around his neck. He stood on his hands, walked up and down the stage, then hopped off and challenged 4 men, picked at random, to a race. They could race on their feet, he'd race on his hands. He promised a bar of gold to anyone who could beat him. They used the aisles of the theatre as a racetrack, and despite his disadvantage, Hans beat the 4 men easily. He claimed he could sprint 100 meters in 8 seconds on his hands, and nobody in the theatre doubted him. Afterwards, he performed some impressive gymnastic feats, proving that a person could manage just as well without legs as with them. His act wasn't especially exciting, but it was enjoyable. There was a short pause after Hans had left, then Mr. Tall came on.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "our next act is another unique and perplexing one. It can also be quite dangerous, so I ask that you make no noise and do not clap until you are told it is safe."
The whole place went quiet. After what had happened with the Wolfman earlier, nobody needed telling twice. When it was quiet enough, Mr. Tall walked off the stage. He shouted out the name of the next freak as he went, but it was a soft shout.
"Mr. Krebsley and Madame Octa."
The lights went down low, and a creepy-looking man walked onto the stage. He was tall and thin, with very white skin and only a small crop of orange hair on the top of his head. He had a large scar running down his left cheek. It reached to his lips and made it look like his mouth was stretching up the side of his face. He was dressed in dark red clothes and carried a small wooden cage, which he put on a table. When he was set, he turned and faced us. He bowed and smiled. He looked even scarier when he smiled, like a crazy clown in a horror movie I once saw. Then he started to explain about the act. I missed the first part of his speech because I wasn't looking at the stage. I was watching Steve. You see, when Mr. Krebsley walked out, there had been total silence, except for one person who had gasped loudly. Steve. I stared curiously at my friend. He was almost as white as Mr. Krebsley and was shaking all over. He'd even dropped the rubber model of Alexander Ribs that he'd bought. His eyes were fixed on Mr. Krebsley, as though glued to him. And as I watched him watch the freak, the thought which crossed my mind was, he looks like he's seen a ghost. Chapter 12.
"It is not true that all tarantulas are poisonous," Mr. Krebsley said.
He had a deep voice. I managed to tear my eyes away from Steve and trained them on the stage.
"Most are as harmless as the spiders you find anywhere in the world. And those which are poisonous normally only have enough poison in them to kill very small creatures. But some are deadly," he went on. "Some can kill a man with one bite. They are rare and only found in extremely remote areas, but they do exist." "I have one such spider," he said, and opened the door of the cage.
For a few seconds nothing happened, but then the largest spider I had ever seen crawled out. It was green and purple and red, with long hairy legs and a big fat body. I wasn't afraid of spiders, but this one looked terrifying. The spider walked forward slowly. Then its legs bent, and it lowered its body as though waiting for a fly.
"Madame Octa has been with me for several years," Mr. Krebsley said. "She lives far longer than ordinary spiders. The monk who sold her to me said some of her kind lived to be 20 or 30 years old. She is an incredible creature, both poisonous and intelligent."
While he was speaking, one of the blue-hooded people led a goat onto the stage. It was making a frightened, bleating noise and kept trying to run. The hooded person tied it to the table and left. The spider began moving when it saw and heard the goat. It crept to the edge of the table where it stopped, as if awaiting an order. Mr. Krebsley produced a shiny tin whistle. He called it a flute, from his trouser pocket and blew a few short notes. Madame Octa immediately leapt through the air and landed on the goat's neck. The goat gave a leap when the spider landed and began bleating loudly. Madame Octa took no notice, hung on, and moved a few centimeters closer to the head. When she was ready, she bared her fangs and sunk them deep into the goat's neck. The goat froze, and its eyes went wide. It stopped bleating, and a few seconds later, toppled over. I thought it was dead, but then realized it was still breathing.
"This flute is how I control Madame Octa," Mr. Krebsley said, and I looked away from the fallen goat. He waved the flute slowly above his head. "So we have been together such a long time. She is not a pet, and would surely kill me if I ever lost it. The goat is paralyzed," he said. "I have trained Madame Octa not to kill outright with her first bite. The goat would die in the end if we left it. There is no cure for Madame Octa's bite. But we shall finish it quickly."
He blew on the flute, and Madame Octa moved up the goat's neck until she was standing on its ear. She bared her fangs again and bit. The goat shivered, then went totally still. It was dead. Madame Octa dropped from the goat and crawled towards the front of the stage. The people in the front rows became very alarmed, and some jumped to their feet. But they froze at a short command from Mr. Krebsley.
"Do not move," he hissed. "Remember your earlier warning. A sudden noise could mean death."
Madame Octa stopped at the edge of the stage, then stood on her two back legs, the same as a dog. Madame Octa stopped at the edge of the stage, then stood on her two back legs, the same as a dog. Mr. Krebsley blew softly on his flute, and she began walking backwards, still on two feet. When she reached the nearest leg of the table, she turned and climbed up.
"You will be safe now," Mr. Krebsley said, and the people in the front row sat down again, as slowly and quietly as they could. "But please," he added, "do not make any loud noises, because if you do, she might come after me."
I don't know if Mr. Krebsley was really scared or if it was part of the act, but he looked frightened. He wiped the sleeve of his right arm over his forehead, then placed the flute back in his mouth and whistled a strange little tune. Madame Octa cocked her head, then appeared to nod. She crawled across the table until she was in front of Mr. Krebsley. He lowered his right hand, and she crept up his arm. The thought of those long, hairy legs creeping along his flesh made me sweat all over, and I liked spiders. People who were afraid of them must have been nervously chewing the insides of their cheeks to pieces. When she got to the top of his arm, she scuttled along his shoulder, up his neck, over his ear, and didn't stop until she reached the top of his head, where she lowered her body. She looked like a funny sort of hat. After a while, Mr. Krebsley began playing the flute again. Madame Octa slid down the other side of his face, along the scar, and walked around until she was standing upside down on his chin. Then she spun a string of web and dropped down on it. She was hanging about 10 centimeters below his chin now, and slowly began rocking from side to side. Soon she was swinging about level with his ears. Her legs were tucked in, and from where I was sitting she looked like a ball of wool. Then, as she made an upward swing, Mr. Krebsley threw his head back, and she went flying straight up into the air. The thread snapped, and she tumbled around and around. I watched her go up, then come down. I thought she'd land on the floor or the table, but she didn't. Instead, she landed in Mr. Krebsley's mouth. I nearly got sick when I thought of Madame Octa sliding down his throat and into his belly. I was sure she'd bite him and kill him. But the spider was a lot smarter than I knew. As she was falling, she'd stuck her legs out, and they'd caught on his lips. He brought his head forward so we could see his face. His mouth was wide open, and Madame Octa was hanging between his lips. Her body throbbed in and out of his mouth, and she looked like a balloon which he was blowing up and letting the air out of. I wondered where the flute was, and how he was going to control the spider now. Then Mr. Tall appeared with another flute. He couldn't play as well as Mr. Crepsley, but he was good enough to make Madame Octa take notice. She listened, then moved from one side of Mr. Crepsley's mouth to the other. I didn't know what she was doing at first, so I craned my neck to see. When I saw the bits of white on Mr. Crepsley's lips, I understood. She was spinning a web. When she was finished, she lowered herself from his chin, like she had before. There was a large web spun across Mr. Crepsley's mouth. He began chewing and licking the web. He ate the whole of it, then rubbed his belly, being careful not to hit Madame Octa, and said,
"Delicious. Nothing tastier than fresh spider webs. They are a treat where I come from."
He made Madame Octa push a ball across the table, then got her to balance on top of it. He set up small pieces of gym gear, tiny weights and ropes and rings, and put her through her paces. She was able to do all the things a human could, like lift weights above her head and climb ropes and pull herself up on the rings. Then he brought out a tiny dinner set. There were mini plates and knives and forks and teeny-weeny glasses. The plates were filled with dead flies and other small insects. I don't know what was in the glasses. Madame Octa ate that dinner as neatly as you please. She was able to pick up the knives and forks, four at a time, and feed herself. There was even a fake salt cellar which she sprinkled over one of the dishes. It was round about the time she was drinking from the glass that I decided Madame Octa was the world's most amazing pet. I would have given everything I owned for her. I knew it could never be. Mum and Dad wouldn't let me keep her even if I could buy her, but that didn't stop me from wishing. When the act was over, Mr. Crepsley put the spider back in her cage and bowed low while everybody clapped. I heard a lot of people saying it wasn't fair to have killed the poor goat, but it had been thrilling. I turned to Steve to tell him how great I thought the spider was, but he was watching Mr. Crepsley. He didn't look scared anymore, but he didn't look normal either.
"Steve, what's wrong?"
I asked. He didn't answer.
"Steve?"
"Shh," he snapped, and wouldn't say another word until Mr. Crepsley had left. He watched the odd-looking man walk back to the wings. Then he turned to me and gasped.
"This is amazing!"
"The spider?" I asked.
"It was great. How do you think..." "I'm not talking about the spider,"
he snapped.
"Who cares about a silly old arachnid? I'm talking about Mr. Crepsley."
He paused before saying the man's name, as though he'd been about to call him something different.
"Mr. Crepsley?"
I asked, confused.
"What was so great about him? All he did was play the flute." "You don't understand,"
Steve said angrily.
"You don't know who he really is."
"And you do?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "As a matter of fact, I do." He rubbed his chin and started looking worried again.
"Just hope he doesn't know I know. If he does, we might never make it out."